And welcome to the Pod of the Damned. I'm your host, Ian. Joining me once again this week, as always, is one third of the team. Nico, how are you doing, buddy?
I'm not bad. You've still not mastered that, but yeah, you're like, you could see you were going, I'll make up something on the spot.
I haven't really thought about how I'm going to do the intros to everyone yet. So that's something I need to maybe go away and think about for the next episode. Because it was when we were doing the Army of the Dead one, and I was like, fuck, I could, because obviously I've done podcasts with more than two people before, but I was like, I don't know how to introduce everyone. So maybe I just need to wrap my head around that. But yeah.
It's a holy trinity now. You're struggling.
Thank you so much for pointing it out.
For pointing it out, yeah. Because I love you that much, that's why.
Is that what it is? Also joining us once again is our other third of the team. See, I fucked it up again. Candy. Candy, the final girl, how are you doing?
I am good. How are you?
I am excellent. I really went to take a sip of my coffee at like the most inopportune moment there, so I'm just going to put it back.
I do that every time.
Candy, yeah. I should apologise because I do try and fuck up his intros quite often, by the way. I should have told you that at the start.
Quite often? You do it every week.
No, it's amazing.
Every week, every episode. And it's not just intros either. It's when I'm trying to do the socials. It's when I'm trying to do the ratings. It's when I'm trying to do fucking everything. Fucking hate you, Nico.
I'm like a gremlin.
I shouldn't laugh because I hosted my own show for a long time, and yeah, I know what that feels like. I'm sorry, but it's also kind of funny.
It's a little funny. I suppose I'll give you that, Nico.
It brightens my day every time. The outro one's the best one because sometimes I just throw it in and do it as well.
Oh, yeah,
and
when you decide that you're going to join in with me with the outro catchphrase, and then you throw it. Anyways,
that's the one that annoys him the most. I love doing that.
We are a horror podcast that deep dives into a different topic every single week in our quest to create a leaderboard of the best and worst horror movies of all time. Today, we are talking all about Misery. We will get into all aspects of the movie and I'm sure many other things in just a couple of moments. Before we do that, if you would like to follow us on our social media platforms, you can do so. We're on X at Damned Podcast, Facebook and Instagram is Pod of the Damned. You can email us at podofthedamned@gmail.com and you can subscribe to us on Patreon, patreon.com/podofthedamned. See what happens, Nico, when you don't fucking interrupt. I just get it right.
I don't even need to interrupt sometimes. I just need to give him a look. Like one time Shira did it for me. It was just the arse on camera and he just broke.
I did. Yeah, I remember.
So,
that.
Yeah.
It was a really close and personal, you know, cat asshole. I didn't really know what to do.
I didn't expect her to do it. She just came over and then I'm like, oh, I just realised what she's doing.
Yeah, I didn't really know what to do with that image and it definitely threw me off track for a couple of moments. But, you know, we're professionals on this show.
Oh, yeah. Cut our souls and try to fuck each other up. Nothing wrong with it.
Absolutely. But yes, we are talking all about Misery. This is my choice of movie this week. As I said in the last episode, this is the final movie that we're going to be covering before we go into our new rotation of movies. So stay tuned to those social media platforms because we will be announcing what movies are going to be coming up in the course of the next couple of days. And of course, as always, we'll be asking you guys, our followers and listeners, to give us your scores and reviews on them all, as well as many other things. Obviously, if you've followed us on social media for a while, you'll have noticed that Candy's also taking part in posting quite a lot of things, especially on our Twitter account, or X account, sorry, should I say. So hopefully you guys will like the new dynamic that we've got going on there as well. So please do go interact with all those things. You can email us your thoughts, you can send us DMs, you can do whatever you like, but please go and do that and follow those accounts. I chose Misery. I was trying to think, right, we went sort of, I feel like we've gone through a period lately, Nico, maybe just before Christmas, where we'd done quite a few, like, of the big blockbuster movies that we'd kind of let fall through the cracks, because we did Jaws, we did The Thing, and part of me kind of wants to, like, keep that little bit of a trend going by picking, like, some of the more popular horror movies. Which obviously is good. It's always good to talk about, you know, the really shitty ones, like last week when we talked about Army of the Dead. But, you know, we like to talk about what I think is one of the great ones as well. So that's why I chose Misery. Before we get into it, as always, we will do our predictions. Nico, Misery, where do you think it's going to come on the leaderboard?
I think it will be top end, but not top 10. I think it'll just be outside it.
Okay, so what do you think? Maybe like 15th, something in that sort
Yeah,
of
something
ballpark?
like that. Yeah, roundabout.
Okay, Candy?
I know how specific those little half points and stuff can get, so I'm gonna say 20-ish.
Okay, so the movies in that sort of 15 to 20 range at the minute, you've got Hereditary, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, The Descent, Prey, Zombieland, Black Phone. Those are the sort of movies that are in there just now.
My favourite of them is Black Phone.
Really?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Because I
Those
watched that
ones are
again
like
recently.
good, but yeah.
I think they're all good movies, and you know, obviously they are because they're that high up in our leaderboard. So it'll be interesting to see where Misery comes. Like I say, there's been a lot of movement up at near the top end of our leaderboard lately anyway, and you're right, Candy, that the difference, so ninth our ninth place movie is an 8.3, and our 23rd place movie is a 7.9. So like the especially at that end of the
The
leaderboard, I
point.
think the more and more you go down the leaderboard, the slightly less it matters because the gaps become a little bit bigger. But especially at that top end of the leaderboard, like in that sort of fifth all the way down, there's fifth to 36th, there's less than like 1 point between all of those movies. So it really,
Jesus.
like getting that extra like half a point, whether that's from one of us or our listeners or the critics, you know, really can make the difference between, you know, a movie maybe being in the top 10 and being in the top 30, you know. So we're definitely getting to that point in our leaderboard, which is great. This is what we want, you know, we want this sort of things. And it also just goes to show, you know, whilst we also have our own personal preferences, like a lot of these movies, even though we think this is a fucking great movie, this movie's maybe not as great, you know, it recognizes that there's maybe not that much in it when you really come down to it and boil down to it. And it takes, I think, into account all the different aspects of different kinds of genres that you can't really compare to one another as well. I think for me, the most difficult one with that is comedy, horror comedy movies. It's so difficult sometimes to rate a horror comedy comparing it to just straight out horror movies because
Oh, yeah.
a lot of people just don't take horror comedy movies seriously. You know, we've obviously got quite a
Well, you're
few.
not meant to,
Well, no, but you know what I mean? They don't take him seriously as a movie. Fuck you, Nico. But you know, we've got quite a few
You
horror.
okay there?
We've got quite a few horror comedy, or a couple, at least a few horror comedies in our sort of top 20. You know, we've got Zombieland in there. We've got Cabin in the Woods. We've got Dog
Shaun of the
Soldiers.
Dead.
We haven't covered Shaun of the Dead yet, so
Not
that's
yet.
not on our leaderboard yet.
That will be getting chucked in.
But that, yeah, that would def for me, that would definitely be up there in that sort of bracket as well.
Oh,
And
yeah.
I've been holding back from picking it because I thought he would have by now.
Yeah, I'm surprised that you hadn't picked it by now.
Was
So
I think
I.
wasn't that the very first movie that me and you collaborated on was Shaun of the
Yes, it
Dead?
was.
It was
That's
the
why I was like,
very
you haven't
yeah.
done
No,
that
that was
yet?
the very first movie that me and Candy ever did a joint episode on, and that was for the it
While
show.
ago.
That was a lot. Yeah, we're talking probably about 4 years
Years.
ago. Yeah, so yeah, so yeah, but like you know, I've gotten a lot of shit from some of our fans for having those movies so high up the list, and it's like, well, you know,
Welcome.
they're really. Wow, that's what Nico thinks of all your opinions, listeners.
This is what I think of it is if you kind of see a comedy horror being good because it's a comedy horror, then there's something wrong.
No, I
It's
don't think
there to
people. I'm
entertain you
not.
that way.
I don't think people are saying they're not good because they're not comedy horror. Because they're comedy horror. I just think they don't
Oh no,
think.
a lot of people say that. A
Okay.
lot of
I
people
think it's
say comedy
harder to
horrors are
rate
shit
a
because they're
comedy
comedy.
horror because you have to take into account the horror and the
Yeah.
comedy. And
Yeah.
sometimes there's dramedy in it, you know,
Yeah.
so it's like a
Yeah.
drama, comedy, horror. Like there's a lot of more aspects and it can get a little dicier on rating them. I'm a
It's
fan of horror comedy, so.
such a fine
I'm a
line.
fan of horror. Yeah. The thing is, I've spoke to people about this so many times, and the most common thing they say is, well, it's not really a horror, is it? It's meant to
Yeah.
be funny. It's meant to be a
It's not really
horror
a
at the
horror,
same
but you
time.
know, they're getting eaten alive by fucking zombies or they're getting fucking
Yeah.
killed by
Right, like
vampires
Evil
or
Dead
whatever.
2. Does it have plenty of like guts and gross stuff? Yeah. Is it hilarious? Absolutely.
Yeah. Oh, hello.
We've got a lot of Evil Dead movies to cover as well, so
Well, you picked the right person.
I think we've covered two Evil Dead movies, right? We've done Army
Yeah,
Dark
because I hate that.
we've done
I
Arm
hate them all.
No, see, Nico, it doesn't work anymore. Because you fucked it up when you tried to convince Candy that you didn't like Stephen King. You can't
My
just do
son's
it.
name is Ash.
Yeah. We've done Army of
What's
Darkness.
your favorite one?
Two.
Two.
My order is 213. When I've had a lot of fights about that order.
See, I'm 231.
That's how most people are.
I'm real. One.
But I chop and change. I chop and change between 2 and 3, though, because I love Army of Darkness. I think it just ups it to the comedy factor.
I got to see
factor.
It with Bruce Campbell presenting it in like the first three rows last year. And that was cool as shit. But then when he did, like, I wore a low cut dress and I was jumping around like, Mr. Campbell, Mr. Campbell. And he's like, you. And I was like, yeah, boobs work. They're great. And he was like, what's your question? I was like, so what's your favorite Evil Dead movie? And I'm like trying to be all like a typical candy there. Hey, what's your favorite? He's like, what do you want it to be? I said, 2. He said, then it's 2.
Typical Bruce Campbell.
Boobs for the win.
Just to put it out there, I'm reboot 2 Evil Dead Rise just to like really piss people off. That's my anyways.
Get out.
We're not here to talk about the Evil Dead franchise, guys.
No, we're not.
Sidetrack people, anyway.
We're on horror said, comedy and we're going a way different direction.
With that being said,
I know we're not even doing a horror comedy at the worst, but
you talking about this fucking movie is hilarious. We're going to go on in today's episode. We're talking all about Misery.
Rob Reiner and Stephen King want to be the first to wish you a Merry Christmas and a safe and sane holiday season. But for novelist Paul Sheldon, it won't be very merry at all. He's spending Christmas in bed.
There is nothing to worry about. You're gonna be just fine. I'm your number one fan.
I think one of my clients, Paul Sheldon, might be in some kind of trouble.
You mean Paul Sheldon, the writer?
This year.
My name is Annie Wilkes.
Number one fan.
He won't be going to any parties.
Oh, Paul, I've read everything of yours, the Misery novels. I love them so.
He won't be seeing any friends.
They said he checked out last Tuesday. Isn't that a little strange?
Paul, say hello to Misery.
Misery.
Yes, I told you I was your number one fan.
He won't be spending time with his family.
Paul, forgive me for prattling away and making you feel all oogie.
He'll have only one person to help him through the holidays.
Catch this.
Mwah! Annie Wilkes.
What a poet you are.
The presumption must now be that Paul Sheldon is dead.
She loves everything he ever wrote.
I'd love to stay here and chat, but I'm right at the end, and I gotta find out what happens.
Except this.
You dirty bird. How could you?
Misery Chastain cannot be dead. You murdered us!
Whatever you're thinking about doing, please don't do it.
It's for the best.
Misery.
God, I love you.
This movie...
The greatest horror comedy ever.
Yes, this movie was released in 1990, was directed by Rob Reiner, and stars Kathy Bates, James Caan, and Richard Farnsworth. The IMDb plot is as follows, because I actually wrote it down this week. After a famous author is rescued from a car crash by a fan of his novels, he comes to realize that the care he is receiving is only the beginning of a nightmare of captivity and abuse. Okay, I think we're all Stephen King fans here.
Safe to say.
Despite Nico's little trick that you played in the last episode.
Provoking of me.
Yes.
Your face is a picture.
what, in terms of like the novels of Stephen King, because obviously I don't think you can talk about any Stephen King adaptation without talking about his work in general, because I think, you know, a lot of it's quite interwoven. In terms of his novels, what's everyone's favorite Stephen King novel?
That's hard.
I like the Dark Tower series, so that's 8 books. Yeah. I don't know if I can count that as one. Can that pass?
I can give you that. We can give you that.
Yeah, I'll take the Dark Tower series.
See, I like that as well, but it's long, so me I not like, long. Like it, but I don't like. But I don't. I got broken for a chase. That's not fair, right? I'm not a very, very big reader, but Stephen King is something I'll read because I'm really badly dyslexic, so it gets jumbled in my head and I end up throwing the book away normally. Stephen King's like one of the only ones that I can actually go from start to finish with. So I struggle reading a lot of stuff. And I see Misery, It, and like those two are the ones that I remember reading first, if you know what I mean. And they always have a special place for me. So I chop and change between them sometimes.
I mean,
but yeah, Dark Tower is amazing though.
I mean, obviously, you know, Stephen King is a lot better writer than he is a director, and we'll probably get into that as well.
That's for goddamn sure.
We'll definitely get into that.
What do you mean?
We'll definitely get into that. I'm kind of with you, Nico. It is my favorite Stephen King novel. For similar reasons, it's the first one of his that I read, and so it's always just been like that sort of special one for me. But in terms of adaptations, let's go into adaptations, because. I think it's safe to say there have been varying degrees of success when it comes to Stephen King adaptations. And obviously, you know, we've had a chat about The Shining, Stanley Kubrick's version of The Shining, and we all have varying opinions on that. The public
famously hate that.
Yeah, the public have, you know, varying opinions on that. I personally really, like, for as much as I dislike Stanley Kubrick, because, you know, he's a piece of fucking shit,
true.
I really love that movie. I think The Shining's fucking great. It's far superior to Dr. Sleep, but we'll not get into that. We'll not get into that debate. But you know, there's such a huge variety in adaptations, and shockingly, the worst Stephen King adaptation is the one that he directed himself, because Maximum Overdrive is fucking abysmal.
That is just coke fueled chaos.
But it's so bad, Nico. We covered that, I think, didn't we?
That's what I'm saying. I'm pretty sure we said it there.
Yeah,
then.
Maximum Overdrive. Oh God, I remember when it came out, because I'm older than you guys. When it came out, I was so excited because I started reading Stephen King when I was really young, because I always read like way above my level. My mom would let me read things, and then she'd explain things maybe I didn't understand, like as a child, like what is sex or something. But yeah, I mean, it was just like I rented that and I'm like, God, that really sucked. And I was like a kid, like 6 or 7, like, wow, that's really awful. She's like, yeah, it was pretty bad. And then later on, he's like, I was on cocaine the whole time. I'm like, yep.
Yeah. Sure, you can tell that one scene. That one scene where he's looking up, like, from the camera up the way, where he's at the ATM bit. You can tell he is fucking on it. Like, that's the reason he's at that ATM, to get more coke.
No, it's a fucking terrible movie. But, you know, like I say, there's... And I think the thing for me is a lot is... Stephen King is obviously just widely known as this being like this horror director, but of course there's some really great non-horror movies that he's got adaptations out there as well. When you think of things like Shawshank Redemption and The Green Mile, which is actually a personal favorite of mine, especially movie wise because
Green Mile's good.
The performances I think in that movie are incredible. But
sure are, boss.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for acknowledging that I'm the boss, Nico. Thanks. But, you know, whether it's The Shining or Carrie or The Mist, which I think sometimes people get sort of a little bit forgotten about, or It or this movie, Misery, I think it's safe to say that, you know, some of the biggest movies out there, some of the most successful movies, some of the most popular movies are Stephen King movies. And that is a credit to him as a writer, because he writes he writes fucking batshit insane off the wall stuff. That's what happens when, you know, you're coked out of your nut for so much of your life. But you know,
nobody mentioned Cujo. That's fucking epic.
But this is what I'm saying. There's so many other stuff you could mention, whether it's, you know, Pet Sematary or it's Thinner or it's whatever it is. Like there's so much work out there. You know, it's really is. And then yeah, so for me, Stephen King definitely. Stephen King is. Is he in our Hall of Fame?
He should
be.
I can't remember.
I remember voting for him, but I don't know if he made it. Because you know, whoever I vote for is the person who doesn't make it.
He didn't make it in, I don't think, yet. I think I'm mixing up because I put him in the other podcast that we did. I remember that.
Was that what it was? He is already in our Hall of Fame.
He is actually in our one.
You put him in the very first year, Nico. He was your first choice.
I thought it was the last podcast that we did.
I think he very possibly wasn't in the old podcast as well, but
probably mix it up. I'm awful for that.
But this is what I'm proving. Like, you know, he was your very first pick on this show to go into our Hall of Fame, and I think that just speaks volumes about the impact that he's had on horror. There's absolutely no denying that horror just would not be the same today if it weren't for Stephen King. Like, he's created genres. He's influenced it so much, and you know, I think he needs to be commended for that.
Yeah.
So let's talk about Misery then, and this movie. I remember when I was like first watching this movie. I first watched this movie when I was like really young. I was like maybe 8 or 9. I was about 10,
yeah.
I remember really, really not liking this film very much. And I remember
probably because of like your age. It's definitely, skewed towards younger viewers. I was 10 when it came out. So,
and I remember
almost 11
as I was going through like my sort of teenage years. So it was maybe like 15, 16. I'd rewatched it, and I remember thinking that. I remember thinking that James Caan was just given like this really bland performance, and I was like, and as I've gotten older, obviously I've learned to sort of love and appreciate this movie to the point now where I actually think it could be considered one of the best Stephen King adaptations there is.
I think he's really good in it as well.
Oh no, that's what I'm saying. This is what I'm saying. Like, my opinion of it came so
well. Oh, when you were younger,
especially
you thought
when
you
shit. Come from a position of, I think that's a mix of like. If you grew up watching The Godfather with James Caan in it, you're getting a different James Caan in this film. And from his, this is definitely like against type for him. So I think it's something that you, Misery is something you understand better when you're older, you have some more life experience.
I think so. I think when you realize just how far sort of out of his own comfort zone James Caan was when making this movie, because apparently he had to spend like 15 weeks in the bed while they were filming all of those scenes. And as you know, James Caan doesn't, he's notoriously not like a reactionary character. For him to do this was so far. And then when you take that into consideration and you look at his performances as a whole, you know, I think he gives a fantastic performance. I think in terms of like, it's a shame for him in terms of performances that he's still so outshone by the absolutely incredible Kathy Bates.
Come on, there's not a lot of people that outshine her.
Well, no, and also you got to, you know, as a former actor, it's you want those kind of media roles, because when you're in a role like, you know, Annie Wilkes with, you know, Kathy Bates playing her, it's a media role than playing like Paul Sheldon, which you have to do very understated. As an actor, if I was trying out and I had to be one of those characters, I would be Annie Wilkes, because it'd be so fucking fun to do. You can do a lot more and do some crazier shit. So I think, you know, in those roles, that's, people get noticed for those roles.
You can go OTT in it and it would still fit. You know what I mean? That's the thing about it.
Oft
his one's got to be more calm and more demure, you know?
Yeah, but she absolutely does. Let's be real. Like, Kathy Bates absolutely chews the scenery.
She is this movie.
The fucking shit out of the scenery in this movie.
And having read the book before seeing the movie, I mean, she's exactly how I pictured Annie.
Yeah, and it's almost, and she gives such a great performance to the point where Stephen King actually wrote future characters with Kathy Bates in mind to play them in adaptations as well.
Like Dolores Claiborne and.
Yeah. So, you know, that's. I think you'd be hard pressed, even if someone's not a massive fan of this movie. I think you'd be hard pressed to find someone who wouldn't agree that Kathy Bates is by far is absolutely incredible. She won a fucking Oscar, you know. And you know how notoriously difficult it is for people in horror movies to win Oscars for fucking anything, because horror movies are so fucking criminally underrated by, you know, the media.
Unless they're thrillers,
especially back then as well.
Yeah.
Like '90s, it was really hard.
Absolutely.
But. I think the thing for me is as well, like, when you think about it and you think about, like, sort of the zeitgeist of horror, and you think about all of your big sort of horror villains and all of your really sort of memorable scenes, and whether that's, you know, Freddy Krueger and Welcome to Primetime, Bitch, you know, whether that's fucking even other Stephen King movies, whether that's Georgie and the drain scene from It. You know, these are all things that are like super fucking memorable. Whether that's, you know, the scene with the priest outside the house in The Exorcist, all these really, really memorable moments. And you can think of, I personally think, you can think of three or four different ones in this movie alone. And they're usually just fucking Paul Sheldon waking up and Annie Wilkes just standing over him with like that sort of dark light. And it's
the bit with the piss that always gets me, yeah. First she's shaking a bottle and I'm like, every time. You know what I mean? It's like, what the fuck, man?
I'm your number one fan.
It's like, oh geez, she's gotta take out Rooney Buck and drink it. That's how fucked up she is. Oh. You know what I mean?
Well, we don't kink shame on this podcast, so you know, if that's what she wants to do, that's what she wants to do.
She's either bathing in it or gargling it. It's one of the two.
Wow. but
you're like twitching. You're like, God,
actually, like someone just like walked over my grave when you said that. Like, I actually couldn't think of anything worse. Just you try and like picture it and imagine waking up, because at this point, right, obviously she's saved him from this car crash.
Yeah.
And she's taken him back to her house and she's fixed him up. And at this point, we don't really know like the passage of time at this point, whether that's maybe he's only been out for a few hours, he might have been out for days, he might have been out for fucking weeks. You know, we don't know at this point. Obviously we find out that it's really not like a huge amount of time. But imagine waking up in a strange house, knowing you've been in a car crash, to someone just staring over you going, I'm your number one fan. I'd be like, get me the fuck out of this place. Like that.
Seeing if pissing the bed, like I think I would. That's got to be horrifying. But what I really like about this story in general is that Stephen King really put himself, Paul Sheldon is a side of himself, you know, in this, you know, all those constant reader number one fans that he has out there, like, what if, you know, what's the fun game to play when you're a writer? What if? And the story does that brilliantly. And it's just, yeah, that's an iconic thing, like you said, very much.
Yeah.
Plus, your number one fan, it depends what she's.
We would call them a stan these days, you know, which is not a good, when people say, I'm a stan for that, I'm like, you know what that is a reference to, right? Not a good thing.
Yeah.
Okay.
But you've just started DJing. You'll get a number one fan, even if you're the shittest DJ in the world.
I already have fun.
Have you got it? How hot? Right, here's the thing. How hot is she?
Well, that's subjective, isn't it?
But in your personal opinion, how hot is she?
All right.
Would you? That's the question.
Oh, no.
I'm not going to answer that on the podcast.
Because this is the thing, right? If you get your number one fan coming up to you and they're like, you're hot as hell, what you prefer, it goes a totally different way from being creepy. It goes, well, this is going to be good.
But it could be like something insanely hot, but maybe not very hinged.
Yeah. Like,
it could go really
crazy
wrong.
Hot scale. You're going to go crazy hot scale.
So you're going to be like, oh, that's fine. We're going to have sex, but she's going to, you're basically basic instincting it. Then you'll end up
with a stalker if you have sex with her. That's the difference.
Well, yeah, but don't have sex with him. It's really not that difficult, is it?
Generally, no, not supposed to do that with your fan base.
It always happens.
I'm very glad that this movie didn't go down that kind of route when it came to coming things like that, because I think, like you said, we'd have been talking about a very different kind of movie, and I don't think that kind of movie would have been anywhere near as good as the kind of movie that we got.
No.
So I'm very glad they didn't go down that route. You know, I completely agree, you know, like, it's really interesting, you know, to... And you do make a valid point in there as well, Nico, you know, about...
It's perspective is what I was meaning.
About, like, your number one fan, you know, and you really don't need to do a whole lot to garner a fan base, if that makes sense. Like, whether that's writing, acting, podcasting, DJ, like, any form of entertainment, and you will, as long as you're, you know, mildly charismatic, which, you know... I like to think I am.
Nicola. Or you post a decent picture on Instagram in your inbox. If you were, I know this happens to men as well, but as a female, and I'm married in my 40s, I get some pretty disturbing, you know, DMs, and I'm like,
yeah.
Oh, okay.
I mean, I've had...
It's why you just get the nude sent to you, and you're just like, what the fuck? Not even a hello, right? It's just a full naked body. You're like,
Nico's like, okay. I want you to wine and dine me, please.
Not even a hi. Hello,
hi.
The
creepiest one I ever had was a girl had sent me one on Facebook, and it was just her butthole.
Oh, no.
Like, not even a hello. Not nothing, just a butthole. How do you and know? I'm like, what the fuck?
How do you know it was
What
hers?
The fuck is this shit? That's the
you
thing.
You can guess what mine
hers.
Were.
Did you?
Well, yeah, yours is guaranteed dick pics. So that's 100%.
Did you? So whenever I show them to Sean, I'm like, you gotta look at this dick. This can't be real. This cannot be a real dick.
Oh.
I said, this is from the other podcast that we did. I don't know if I've told you this story or not, but I was DJing one night and the girl found out I did the podcast. She's like, I really like your voice in that, because I sing when I'm doing it as well. She's like, I like the fact your voice is different to the way you sing. I'm like, all right, fair enough. So I told her about the podcast. She was on the podcast thing. She fucking heard that I liked, I think it was It or something like that. And she basically sent a clown sitting on her lap and nothing else on. It was perfectly placed to cover everything. I'm pretty sure it was It we were talking about.
Oh.
So yeah, that
I'm
was
not
quite
gonna
creepy.
Lie, guys, I really didn't think this is what we were going to be talking about.
I'm surprised by the turn of events myself.
We've all
this
dealt
isn't
with
my first fucking rodeo, I guess.
Like, well, I'm 43 now. That's how old I was on my birthday, and for 20-odd years I've DJed, and I've DJed in different places in the world, and I'm not going to lie, the ones abroad are even crazier.
I bet.
We're just talking
so
about
yeah,
Scottish
you've got all that to come yet. Oh no, you think that? No, no, no. Scottish women are normally quite sane compared to the rest of Europe. Trust me.
Wow. Okay, well that's, so we last week we lost our Canadian audience. This week we're losing our European audience.
Nico, hey, I'm not saying it's a bad thing. Nico, I'm just saying they are more crazy.
Please leave
us. You gotta remember, it's the crazy hot scale. Barney has reduced everyone at this time.
Okay. I've completely forgotten what the fuck we were even talking about before this when it
I don't know.
In relation to Misery. You know,
it was the perspective of if you find the person attractive or not that's your number one fan I was trying to get across.
Okay. Okay. No, listen, I get that. Like, listen, well, I think whether you're a guy or a girl, obviously it's different for women because, you know, like you say, I'm sure the number of DMs that women get in comparison to, like, the number of DMs we get, the scale will be, like, so at polar opposites, you know.
Get victim blamed as a female a lot. Like, were you posting something sexy? No, I'm not sexy. It wasn't that, I promise.
Yeah. So, you know, like, that scale is totally different. You know, as obviously someone who's not DJed for anywhere near as long as you have, Nico, because I've only really been doing it for about 6 to 7 months now. But having...
Normally where you get your number one fan coming up.
Well,
just after about a month and a half.
You know, having people who do, you know, like the things that I do, and I've had people come up. And listen, I did a Valentine pub quiz a couple of weeks ago, and I made a bonus round where I said, I started off the poem... Roses are red, violets are blue. And I asked all the participants to finish the poem in various funny and amusing ways for, like, bonus points. I thought it was really fun. And
yeah.
I can tell you that I got 4 different girls' phone numbers back. I got 3 mm-hmm. propositions to go into the toilets to engage in some lewd activity, which... I would just like to say at this point, I reject it. You know, so, you know, this shit fucking happens. Like, these.
Have you had the DJ box one asked for yet?
Yeah.
Yeah, that is the go-to for girls for some reason. Yeah. They want to come behind and dip down.
My experience has always been guys in bands, and I learned very quickly throughout my 20s that that's a bad thing for me.
That's creepy. A guy in a van.
No, seriously, there are plenty of women who, in a band, like, who plays music.
On a band, that's what you said, a van. I'm like
no. But a guy in a band, they usually have bands that they do horrible things in. But yeah, I was a musician and I met guy musicians and I thought we would appreciate each other's musicianship, but those guys were all fucking slags. They were terrible people. And I learned very quickly,
singers and drummers are the biggest slags in the planet.
Yes.
And that goes for both sexes.
Guitarists,
I'm not being sexist. That is the genuinely, drummers and singers are worse than the guitarist.
I was with a guitarist and a singer. Bad mistakes.
But this is also what I'm sort of talking about as well, because so obviously, you know, we've all had, you know, varying levels of this. And I'm certainly not saying that every single person who approaches a musician or a DJ and says, oh, I'm a big fan, and, you know, they want to sleep with them or whatever else, I'm not saying they're all crazy, because, you know, some of them...
No, but you will get the crazy ones coming.
But this is what I'm saying to you, though. This is like... This does translate to the film as well, because I think... I don't know if you guys feel about this, but I think as this film sort of progresses on, because I am desperately going to try and drag us back to the film.
I should be helping, I'm sorry.
I think as the film progresses as well, I do feel like Annie Wilkes thinks that there is a more romantic element in this as well. Yeah.
She's like, I love you.
Yeah.
And he's like, it's kind of like he has a look on his face like, seen, like, you know, read the message, not responding, you know, like a mental version of that. She definitely feels that way. We don't get the backstory. This is, I have to bring it up. The book, you know, obviously there's a lot more you can do in a book than a film. And I did read the book prior to this, to seeing this. And, you know, she's like, I love you. And he's kind of like, you know, what would you do in that situation? I think when we watch a lot of these horror films, we think, what would I do? And I'm like, would you try to reciprocate that because you feel your life is at stake? Like, would you fuck your way out of this? Would you try to fake a romantic relationship?
100%.
I think if I knew that my life was in danger and that this person was trying to keep me captive and potentially ultimately going to kill me, I probably would, yeah.
It very much 100%. Feels like that's his only power move, is to have some sort of relationship with her, whether it's, I'm going to write for you, being like her own Scheherazade or whatever. You know, he's got to give her something, some kind of relationship, even if it's a friendship, like, hey, Annie, let's have dinner with me tonight. She's like, oh, Paul, you know, so that's where he sees, like, he has some power here, but it's in a situation that none of us really want to get down to the wire in, like, can I fake this? Can I do this? But I think when it comes down to the wire and you get into this mental de-evolution of Paul, like, you see that it's absolutely on the table after a certain point. Like, yeah, I'll do whatever I got to do.
Yeah, you know? That's why I was bringing up the whole, like, if you found him attractive or not. Because if you watch the movie, towards the end of the movie, he's using that to his advantage because he's making out he's wanting to have that relationship with her. He's using that to escape. That's why I was bringing it up.
Right.
And that's... I know we went off on a tangent with it, but that's sort of why I was bringing it up.
We've never gone on a tangent on this podcast at all.
Never.
I've never gone on a tangent in my life.
But no, it is a valid point. It's a valid point to bring up because you're right. And I think he does absolutely use that to his advantage. You know, even in that final, like that final scene where he knows the gig is up. He knows she plans to kill him. And she's planning this murder-suicide. But even right there at the very end, you know, he's still using that to his advantage when she comes in with the Dom Perignon, as she says, or, you know, and he's like, oh, but we're going to need two glasses for this one.
And she's like, oh,
Paul, you know, and it's just like, he absolutely uses it to his advantage. But as you said, Candy, you know, it's in a situation where he either does that or he's fucking dead, because if he didn't do that, that would have happened. She'd have shot him and then shot herself and it would have been fucking game over. So
So like, I think any of us, when it came down to the wire, we would absolutely do the same thing.
Yeah.
No matter 100%. How gross or weird you felt about it. Like, sure, that's all I got going for me right now. This is the only thing I can use because my body has failed me and I'm not strong enough. I'm locked in this place. She's got a gun. What can I do? I can romance her.
Yep.
I think
you use whatever tool you could to survive. This is the thing that everyone forgets about horror movies. It's an escape, right? You're looking at this half the time going, well, that person's a fucking dumbass because they should have done this instead. And a lot of folk that like watching horrors, a lot of them would probably survive it because they would have shagged her well before that to get out of there.
But the thing is I think this is one of the things about this movie is there isn't really that sort of there's maybe one or two moments in the movie where you're like, oh, why have you fucking done that? But there isn't really a lot of that moments. I think the biggest one for me is when he's like looking around the house and he puts the penguin back, like the little statuette back the wrong way.
And you're like,
but he's not going to know that. Well, so no, but
I think the thing is for me is I think he maybe would have known that because he's so careful about everything else, even to the point where he's like, oh, I better shut this. Like, because when he's like, we're rolling back in, and he notices he leaves like the living room door open, and he goes back to close it, and it's like, I don't know about you guys, but I can't fucking remember whether or not I leave like doors open or you know stuff.
I don't usually pay attention. Exactly. I have ADHD, and I don't medicate. For reasons I can't write books, oddly enough, when I take ADHD medication, but like that penguin is very important in the book, and you know anybody who knows it's kind of like and they do zoom in on it, but it's like, you know, we do get that kind of adrenaline rush of it almost breaking, so maybe he was just like shit, you know. So I can kind of excuse it because of that.
That's exactly it.
Because it is one of those things, you're not looking at every single ornament where they are, you're like, shit, I'll put it back. It's like if you're at a house party and you knock something over, you pick it up, you didn't know where it was, you know roughly, but you put it down just to, like, you know, as close as you think it would be in your head.
Especially you're thinking, at least it's not broken.
Yeah.
Exactly.
You can get away with that one right away.
Yeah. Exactly.
I think... one of the things for me as well, and it's going back to that sort of like romantic aspect that we were touching upon as well. One of the great things for me about this movie is like, obviously, you know, when we get these sort of big reveals towards the end of the film, whether that's, you know, and we get hints about sort of about her past as the movie goes on. You know, she randomly brings up at one point about, you know, oh, when I was on the witness stand in Denver, and we're like, yeah. Why were you on the witness stand? But we don't know about it at this point. Obviously, later in the movie, we then find out that she's this like killer nurse who's been killing newborn children. But up until that point, that we as a viewer, we also like can't see past the mask, and we can see that the mask slips at various points. You know, when she's having that argument of him about the profanity in his book, which.
Yeah.
Speaking of horror comedies, gives that sort of funny
scene. It's hilarious.
Yeah, where she's
one bastard of a chick.
Yeah, you know,
which is helping or whatever.
All those examples. And the mask starts to slip. But I don't know if you guys felt the same, but in the beginning, I really did think that she didn't have the intention of killing him, that there maybe was just a more romantic angle to this, which we do see, but we obviously then know about her past as well, which means ultimately they're maybe wasn't that, and she just kind of wanted to like replace him, because that was also sort of her theory at one point, was that she, especially, it was a theory she gave Buster, and I will come on to Buster because I want to talk about him, and there is but obviously like she was playing off to him that, oh, she's going to replace Paul. It wasn't even a case of it was going to be murder suicide, she was going to replace
him. Never really bought that one though, because
if she
felt like she could write these stories, she would have been doing it long ago. I know when I first read Stephen King, I wasn't a number one fan or anything, but I thought, I want to do this with this kind of thing, so I started writing, and it's shit for a long time, and then you finally get good and you find your own voice. But like, if she could write these stories and generate them, because she's much more of a voyeuristic type. She loves the romance. She doesn't get romances. She wants to read about them because then they're pure. They don't, you know, there's nothing to corrupt them. And then, you know, there's these historical romances of all things, which are very, very moral, upright kind of books. I've read them. But like,
so Mommy and Porn is what we call it. Mills and Boone.
But like, you know, like speaking of like when I said, you know, his Scheherazade, like, yeah, in playing that, you know, it's like an old tale, Middle Eastern, telling tales to save your life and continuing telling these stories as a way to buy your life. Like, oh, there's more though. So it becomes that to her, and she loves the entertainment, like mentioning the chapter plays, which she does at one point, or the serials or whatever you want to call them that they used to do back in like the 40s and the 50s and the 30s and all that shit. She likes the entertainment, and she doesn't want to have any part of it. She calls it magic, and she doesn't possess that magic, but she wants to partake in that magic.
Yeah.
So she, you know, more that's, I think, the reason why she keeps him alive. Like, you killed this misery that I love. So, and misery has so many uses here, but like misery, the character, you killed misery. Now you got to bring her back, and you got to write your way out of this, because you're going to fucking entertain me, or I'm going to fucking kill you.
Yeah.
Is that simple?
Arabian Nights and its divinity there, you know?
Right.
Yeah, and it's like you say, Misery is like extrapolated as well. We're not just talking about Misery as the character. She's like, you know, killing off the misery, you know, bringing that misery into her life as well, you know, that as an emotion, you know, because again, I go back to it as well about the sort of past, the past story of Annie Wilkes. And we find out in this movie, and it's been a long time since I've read the book, so I can't really remember a huge amount about it. But obviously in the movie, she references the fact that she used to be married and is no longer, that he left her. I can't remember if that's a big sort of plot point in the book.
Yeah, he divorced her.
He divorced her.
Because... Yeah, is it not in the cuttings in this?
Is it?
Yeah, it's...
Is it in the
I think so, if I remember rightly.
I can't remember if I saw it in the cuttings.
I think it's one of the first ones in her scrapbook because it progressively gets worse. So I think it's one of the first ones you always forget, you know?
Yeah.
It does mention
something
about it.
Starts with the father and then moves on. She marries this guy and then it gets divorced. He
divorced
her,
it.
Which is, and they make a point of it being like, he divorced her because it's rare. Usually a woman divorces the man.
Yeah. And does this, sorry if I'm being ignorant here. I cannot remember. Does it say in the book why they divorced?
He started seeing how unhinged she could be.
Okay.
And they began to argue, and she let him live, which is rare. But one thing they don't reference in the movie, which I think would add a little bit of more aspect into the film, I do wish the movie was about 30 minutes longer. I'm going to go ahead and say that, because I really think we could benefit from some of these enriching tales like that are in the book a little bit more. But like, there was another guy, this hitchhiker she picked up. She had a sexual relationship with him. He was like a lot younger, and she cut him up in the bathtub. Yeah. And dispose of him in the way that she disposes of Paul Sheldon's car, which we do find in the movie, but not in the book. So you know this is something she's done before, sort of. But this is her favorite writer. It was just like happenstance.
I think
perfect timing for her.
Right.
It's the perfect thing for her would be that him, and it's the book as well. See when she's setting fire to the book in the movie, it's brilliant. I think because. The way that happens is just flicking it over him, you know? And you're like, oh, shit, it's going to really go.
There's that really sort of tense standoff between them as well, where he's, you know, trying to obviously bluff his way out of burning the book. And he's like, oh, there's loads of guys out there. And she's just like, well, do it then. On you go. There's that really sort of tense I really love that moment.
But also not counting on his number one fan knowing his rituals.
Yeah, because you feel like, especially also in the earlier part of the movie, Paul Sheldon is underestimating Annie Wilkes so much.
Very much.
And what she knows and what she's actually capable of. Because, you know, I think it's like one of the sort of questioning parts of this movie. I'm like, well, in real life, would Kathy Bates be able to drag James Caan out of that car and, you know,
rescue? She's pretty sturdy. Who knows?
But, you know,
the crazy scale. Yeah.
Well, that's what I'm saying. You know, so like, you know, there's one of the things. Just on that note as well, I don't think he's surviving that car crash, you know, anyway, but by the by, to be honest. There's just a suspension of disbelief. But one of the things I want to talk about, because, like, obviously there's a huge thing about sort of mental health in this movie as well, and mental illnesses, because, you know, it's very, very clear that Annie Wilkes as a character suffers from a multitude of mental illnesses. And there's that sort of aspect on it where you're like, well, is this something that had already happened to her? And then she went, you know, was she sort of younger and had all these mental illnesses and went on to, you know, murder all these children? Or, you know, did potentially her husband divorcing her cause her to have a psychotic break? You know, there's those.
That's something I think the viewer has to figure out for themselves. And, you know, and you do yourself a disservice by not reading the Stephen King novel, because you do find out that this is something she's had since she was a kid. She was murdering kids in her apartment building, set it on fire. Things like that. So you know it's something that she just has always had.
Right.
It's kind of like break.
Yeah. And like you say, obviously, you know, the movie doesn't go into depth without a lot of those sorts of aspects. So for those of the people who are out there who maybe haven't seen or read the book, sorry, you know, we are left to sort of go with our own sort of opinions on that. I always read it before I read the book. Like I say, it's been a long time since I read the book. I read it once. But before I read it, when I'd seen the movie, I had always gone with, it was the husband divorcing her that had given her this psychotic break, because just because of the way she sort of brings it up and the way she sort of talks about it in the movie. And then obviously
in her strange relationship with men, you know, not knowing how to relate to them. I mean, and if for the purposes of the film, it really doesn't matter when it happens. because it already has happened. But it is neat. When, I wish we could have more time with the memory lane thing, because it does explain a little bit more. But
yeah,
but for the purposes of the film, it really doesn't. It's not something you have to linger on. But it would be cool, like I said, if we had 30 more minutes to put into this movie, put a little bit of that in there.
I think
I would have liked more backstory in the movie. I'm not going to lie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And one important thing, if I can just do it now, that I do wish was included in the film, like I said, those extra 30 minutes I would have put on as the director. There's a very important theme throughout Paul's captivity, and it is also keeping him prisoner as much as Kathy Bates or Annie Wilkes is his addiction to Novril. He's an addict. And that is its own kind of prison, its own kind of misery. And the whole reason he even has the nerve to break out of his room is she has disappeared to what is called her laughing place. And he has said no food, no drink, no drugs. And it's the drugs that make him go, because he's already drank his piss and everything else by then. The drugs make him break out of the room. And he goes, he finds her stash of the, what I'm assuming are codeine-based pills or morphine-based. And he's hooked on them so bad that he does that before food, water, anything else. That's the whole reason he leaves the room. And I think it's important.
Sort of touches on in the movie. Oh, sorry.
It does a little, but it never shows him like full on addicted, because away, dumping those pills into the mattress with the plan and not taking them. Whereas in the book, he was like down him so bad, like he almost passes out or almost ODs at one point. So it's like, I really wish we could have included that. And I think if the movie was made now, it absolutely would be a longer
100%.
Longer, you know, because it's nothing right now to have a movie that's 3 hours long and people are going to sit for that. They're going to be fine with that. But in 1990, no, they would not. It just, unless you're fucking Martin Scorsese back then doing Goodfellas or something at that time period, you're not going to get away with a movie that long. So yeah, that's an important part of the story to me, that there's more than one prison. There's more, you know, addiction is something that hits really close to home for me. And I think it's important just to have that represented. So I wish I could have, if I could direct this film, I would put that back in there, but the film does not suffer for it. It's just, it only suffers for me a little bit because I read the book first. I think if I'd seen the movie, then read the book, it would have been a different story.
So yeah, I saw it the other way.
Yeah,
I saw it the other way and I agree with you, but I saw the movie first and read the book after. And I agree with you. I would have liked to have kept the addiction part. And I like the subtle nod that you don't really notice when you're watching the movie, where he breaks the pill and then tastes it. And then you see his brain sort of work out, that's what I'm needing. You know, I like that. Watching the film the first time, you don't notice that.
Right.
But as soon as you read the book, you notice it straight away. And that's what I was trying to say. I would have let it touches on it, but not properly. And I agree with you. I would have liked to have seen that in the movie, because just when he breaks it open and his eyes light up when he does it, and he does it so well, and it makes more sense if they'd had something about the addiction at that point.
And there's another thing about the addiction, but it has to do with the ending. I can bring it back up then if you'd like.
No, you can carry on.
I like the ending in the book better. It does deal with addiction the entire time, including the ending. And there and the ending is much more bleak in the book, where it's just kind of like wrapped up. I got some trauma, but we're good. In the book, he's an alcoholic now. He misses the drugs so much that he wishes Annie was still alive and he was still prisoner. You know? Yeah. And it's like, you know, and that's Stephen King again. This is his story, a version of himself. He was clean by then from the cocaine and the alcoholism. It's him writing his way out of it or dealing with his own trauma. And so, you know, every person who's ever been an addict, and I happen to know some, myself included, it's not a secret, it was a long time ago, but bad circumstances in my life left me within two kind of prisons like this. But you know, at the end, he's kind of like, there's those moments when you're weak, and he doesn't like relapse or anything, but he's like, I was still back in that room with all the drugs and Annie was still alive, because then I'd have my fix. You know, that's that hole that after you're an addict, it gets left there a little bit different for everybody else. And some people can conquer that and some people can't. And I think it's an important part of the story.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think
100%
combining those sorts of two messages, whether that's about addiction or mental health, you know, I think these are two things that I think if you're just looking at this movie on a surface level, that can be sort of overlooked almost, right. But they're two like huge in absolutely integral parts of this movie, because obviously, you know, I've having sort of read up on it and knowing a thing or two about mental health issues myself, you know, she Annie Wilkes displays a variety of sort of symptoms or traits that are associated to mental health. She shows signs of being bipolar. She shows signs
definitely
of,
mood disorder, absolutely.
Yeah, she shows signs of obsessive compulsive disorder,
major depressive.
Yep, schizophrenia, Munchausen's. She definitely sort of displays a whole variety of these things, and that's why I sort of brought up the whole sort of point about the husband, because and it does sort of apply, I think, a little bit as well to what you were saying there about addiction too, that, you know, again, speaking from personal experience, when you're going through like a really bad time and you're in your dark places and things like that, it's almost like there's a part of you missing, and you know there's a part of you missing, but you can't quite figure out what that part is for you know, a lot of people. And, you know, some people use medication to help them sort of find that part or sort of forget about part, and that works for some people and that's great, and other people don't, and it just like a representation of, like, Annie Wilkes, obviously, again, going by the book, this is something that she's been doing since she was a small child. We don't get that in this film, so you are left pondering the questions, you know, what has caused this, what makes her suffer. She's very isolated in this movie, you know, she only goes into town to go to the shop, but, you know, we can see that there's no one else in her home, her phone,
and she's very abrasive to everyone.
The scene where, you know, she has the argument with the other driver, you know, when she's like going to the store to get the correct type of paper, you see how easily she snaps at Paul Sheldon, even though she's his number one fan, when he's like, oh, this paper doesn't work, or, you know, something along those lines. And so she's very isolated. The phone in her home isn't even real, so she has no other contact. She has no friends. There's no one there in her life. And
you start to realize why.
Yeah, 100%. So I just really love the way, you know, like you were talking about addiction, like the mental health issues, like the character, like there's these layers, you know. I mean, Jesus Christ, in our last episode, we had the least layered characters, the least.
And there were so many.
Yeah, there was just no depth in any of those. And then we come to here, and there's so much to get into with Annie Wilkes.
And it's a very sparse cast, honestly.
Because realistically, you've got your two main characters. Out with those, obviously, you've got his agent, but she only really appears very briefly at the beginning and the end and a couple of times in the middle.
Lauren Bacall, by the way.
And we've got the chief, the sheriff, sorry, not the chief, the sheriff, Buster, and his wife, and
the deputy.
What is it with that,
right? Every fucking movie that has the wife as a deputy, they're always trying their luck in the car. They've married the budge, not the fucking copper, have they? Everyone.
I love his wife in this film.
She's a trip.
She's great.
Yeah.
Keeping the spice in her marriage.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'd rather be at home fucking, darling, than try to find somebody that could be deed. Let's say it.
When you're in this, you're my deputy, not my wife. And she's like, damn it.
Yeah.
Trying to do a really bad Southern accent.
Do you want to put the cuffs on? Aye, let's go.
But she's also, she's really witty as well. You know, there's that moment where she's like, oh, we got a phone call. Busy morning. You know, like, she's really funny as well. But, you know, Buster, there's obviously this, like, huge trope in horror that the police are useless. And in this movie, Buster actually good police work.
Yeah.
And gets
does it right.
Blown away for his troubles. But I
like that, though.
Oh, okay.
I really like that.
No.
I was agreeing with you. I like that.
Buster serves to, like, he's kind of like a combo of a couple different characters, and he goes out different than the book. But yeah, I mean, I wasn't expecting it when it happened. I thought maybe he'd leave, come back, then something would happen to him. Or, you know, maybe he'd make it all the way through. I really didn't know what to expect, because I'm like, well, Buster's a character that's like a conglomerate of several. So how's this going to go? I mean, he's obviously not going to get run over by the lawnmower, spoiler alert for the book, or anything like that. So what's going to happen here? So that did leave me on the edge of my seat. Like, I like Buster, you know, you can't help but like him. He's a likable guy.
Yeah.
And you're really like, oh man, he's doing some great police work for this sleepy little town. You know, it kind of like, you're blown away by it. You're like, shit.
Yeah, and I think...
Yeah, 100%.
I think this is one of the things that this movie does really well, because there's quite a few of those, like... Because, I mean, horror fans love their villains, right? But you do genuinely, you are rooting for James Caan and Paul Sheldon to get out of this situation in this film, because, we can sort of imagine the horror of it. There's no... You know, there is no supernatural element to this movie. There is no sort of like this is purely like psychological. This is purely like this could happen, right? And yeah. So therefore, we really want Paul Sheldon to get out of this situation. And there's so many of those oh shit moments, I think, in this film.
Let's get to some of those moments, because there's the hobbling.
Well, we'll yeah. start with the hobbling scene. Obviously, in the book, it's not a hobbling scene.
A different kind of hobbling.
Yeah, she cuts his foot off and cauterizes the wound, and yeah, but this fucking
it's pretty
scene,
brutal.
This fucking scene, and it's quite near the end of the movie that this scene actually takes place.
One of the few scenes in horror that actually make me go ooh.
But that's
thing. What I said to him. That's what I said to him. Like, did you wince this morning when you saw it?
Yeah, but that's the thing.
I think I do more since I became disabled. The whole right lower half of my body is affected. I have to use a wheelchair sometimes. I think it hurts me more now than it did before, because I know what that kind of pain feels like. You know, I have a pain pump, fentanyl in it, and I take codeine pills every day because it's just unimaginable pain. And I'm just like, and it is my foot. It is my leg. It is my hip. And I feel that the older that I get and now that I'm disabled, I'm like, oh, fuck, man. God. Ow.
So, I was out of commission for 3 years. I couldn't work for about 3 years, just under, because of an ankle injury. And same thing. Before, I was like, ooh, that hurts. See, now, it's as if that ankle just instantly goes again. It is, as soon as she lifts that sledgehammer up and hits the first one, honestly, it feels like I need my ankle operated again. I'm like, how does it even get to your brain that way? It's just so well done.
And it seems to affect people on a very visceral level, because much like, you know, I represent Fulci, but like, you know, goes for the eyeballs and the fingernails, because that is where people go, oh no, you know, you want to cover your eyes. You feel that kind of pain. And if you felt any kind of pain like that, and for such an understated effect, it really is, considering all the gore films I watch, it's really understated, but it's so fucking well done. It's up there. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's really good.
Well, that's the thing, like, because although there is that sort of brief moment where you do see his ankle go, it is very brief. It's there and it's away. But it just leaves enough to the imagination, doesn't it?
I'm thinking it's K&B that did this. Early K&B, like Greg Nicotero's company.
Yeah.
I know Savini he was directing at this point. So I'm thinking K&B, who was like kind of the successors, did this, and they did it just right.
Yeah.
They did it just right. Just showed
they
enough.
They showed just enough. Just enough. Right. That's what, 100%. It is literally just enough to make you go, fuck. And then it's just enough to make your mind, because that's what I mean by, like, before I ever had an ankle injury or anything, I didn't feel it as much as I did, like, and it's just enough to trap it in your brain to throw it to you.
They don't
it's
even like, have to show the other foot, because she gets
exactly,
both. You just see the one, and you're like, I'm good, thank you. That's
what I was just the way to say. Yeah, 100%. You don't even need to see the second one. Yep. So it's a really good one. Like,
and I think because there's, you know, this is a movie that's got little to no gore. It's not a particularly violent movie until, you know, the very end sort of scenes. Everything is psychological. Everything is verbal that really goes through, barring, you know, a couple of moments. But, you know, we're not talking about egregiously violent, you know, when she throws the ream of paper onto his legs, which, yeah, will hurt him because his legs are fucking broken. But, you know, it's not like a ridiculously violent scene. So for it to go from that and to this, like, that's so shocking for this movie. Like, that's a moment that's just like, we're watching this, you know, sort of psychological horror movie that's, you know, all about intensity and the tension of the scenes. And there is so many of them. And we've, you know,
it's brilliant pacing is what it is. You know, really holding out your fucking good cards till the end. Like, I'm going to show you just a little. And when we get there, it's going to be like, slam, you know, here you go.
Because, you know, obviously at this point of the movie, you know, he knows that she's not going to let him go. I still think at this point of the movie, he's not really 100% certain, like, just how far she go. Is she actually keep? She's obviously mentioned it, because she mentions it pretty early on when the mask finally slips. You know, that moment where she tells him, I've not fucking contacted anyone, and if I die, you die. You know?
Yeah.
And they're... But you maybe would still have that doubt whether or not she's actually capable of doing that, if you were him as a character. And this scene, obviously, is the one that finally just sort of snaps at. And then after this movie, like, he obviously, during that sort of final confrontation, plays along just enough. But I really love that moment where she's, like, waving to him from out in the farm, and he just fucking gives her the middle finger. And he's, you know,
yeah.
Point, oh, you fooler.
Yeah, at this point.
She laughs about it. And I'm like, I would be afraid to do that, because I'd be afraid that bitch would come fuck me up.
Yeah, but at this point, like, he's just full on fuck you mode. Like, you've put me through so much imaginal pain.
Hey, you gotta be psychologically thinking, like, at this point, man, check it out. Might not be such a bad idea.
Yeah.
And I know that that's dark. That's fucking dark for me to say that, because I am not a suicidal person. But, you know, I think everybody goes through pretty dark periods in their life where, like, man, this is not going to get better. And, you know, you got to think he's at that point. Like, it doesn't fucking matter.
Yeah, 100%. And I think that's really sort of a testament to James Caan and the actual performance he gives. Because I want to sort of take it back to the point I made earlier, where, you know, when I was younger, I actually found his performance to be quite bland. But then when you look into it, and it's deeper, you know, and how difficult it would actually be to, you know, portray this sort of character who's going through so much pain, and, you know, is wanting to play along, but is mentally at the point where he can't play along anymore. Like, it's such a fine, like, a niche emotion that he needs to try and portray. And I think he does it absolutely perfectly to that point. You know, he's, you know, earlier on in the film where he is sort of like trying to lead her on and say, oh, well, maybe you can give the book a title. Maybe you can do that. Like, he's trying to, like, appease her to the point where he can make his escape attempts.
What is it? The grave digger's named after her or something?
Yeah, I do love the fact where she's like, you have to change everything, but keep that bit in.
that's the bit I was just going to say. I'm sure it's the gravedigger.
Yeah, I think it is the gravedigger. But, there, you know, there's so many other oh shit moments in this movie as well. And again, they're not even like big things. Like, they're not big set pieces. But the moment, I think the other big one for me is, because you try and put yourself into his shoes, is when they're having dinner and he spikes the drink and she spills the drink. We've spent so much time with him sort of concocting this plan. Right, he's gonna hide the drugs, he's gonna put all the drugs together, he's gonna knock him out, and he's gonna knock her out and gonna make his escape attempt. And just in that split second, that's all done. That's gone.
It's like,
can
fuck.
We start again? But she says, can we start again? And he's like, oh yeah, we totally can.
And can I speak on the score in that? And, you know, like, I'm not a huge Liberace fan. But, like, the use of sound in this movie is so good. You know, using the Liberace, like, upbeat, you know, strong piano, like, kind of thing. And then later on, the Moonlight Sonata on piano. I mean, I just think it fits really well. Having this, like, fun Liberace thing. And then it toned down to a really dark piece, like the Moonlight Sonata. So it's so great. And it just, it meshes perfectly with what's going on the screen every time.
It's 100%. Like, the score in it does do this justice. And it's not often that a movie has that perfect score, and I think it is very, very good in this.
Yeah, no, I would agree. I would agree with both of you guys there. That's absolutely true. Spot on for me. I think one of the other things about this movie is, like, it just makes you feel uncomfortable. There's something just unsettling about so much that happens in the scene. And there's, like, whether that's, like, how Annie, you know, what the things she says, because even right at the very beginning, she openly admits to him, oh, I was actually following you. You know, that's, like, one of the first things that she says to him. I was following you. So, you know,
and you see that on his face, because it has to be a subtle performance, that kind of shock, then, like, I have to register that this is okay.
Yeah.
With that, what? Oh. You know, but without any words, you know, so that's really well done.
You know, and then it goes back to some of the scenes we've already talked about as well, whether that's the scene where, you know, she's shaking his pee at him, you know, and it's just like, she's not being, like, aggressive to him, but there's something just a little unsettling about it, you know?
Or when she brings in Misery the pig, that's a little weird.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the scene where she gets...
That too, I've got to feed you to. That's basically what that is.
Yeah. And, you know, I think one of the things, but there's moments where you feel like physically... I don't know if you feel the same. There's moments where I felt like kind of physically uncomfortable watching this, and I'm not talking about anything that's particularly violent, but I'm talking about when he's trying to make his escape attempt and you look at how sweaty he is, and you look at, like, you know, and it just, I think it just like portrays the pain and how uncomfortable he is, because I'm sure we've all done that, not when we're trying to escape from being, you know, held captive, but I'm sure we've all maybe been in situations where we're either in pain or, you know, something, or we're ill or something like that, where you go to do something and it makes you sweaty, it makes you uncomfortable, and you're just left there. Or if it's, even if it's just like a particularly hot day outside and you're, you know, you're all,
basically your body just screamed back at you like, I'm not gonna do that.
Yeah, and we all know how uncomfortable that. I don't know about you guys, but there's something about it in this film that just, it gets under my skin a little bit. I don't know if that makes sense.
I've told you this story before, but like, one of the creepiest things I ever had was, I went back with a girl for a one night stand, and in the morning she was like, oh, I've lost my keys, so I'm locked in her flat. And she's like, oh, I can't remember where my keys are. And I'm like, this is fucking creepy. And then I didn't tell her where I worked, but I was DJing at the time. And 2 days later, she appeared there. I didn't tell her about a week and a half after that where I was working Sparky, and she just happened to be walking along the road when I was coming out for lunch. And I'm like, yeah, so that was one of the creepiest things I've dealt with.
That's scary.
Yeah.
It was way too much coincidences. But I wasn't caring too much, because I was going to Norway like 3 weeks after that anyway. So I was like, I'm out of here. I've just got to deal with this for 3 weeks, and then that's it, you know. But even then, I still got like texts and like phone calls at random times and stuff. So yeah, I understand the whole creepy bit, because that one, I basically jumped out the window from a first floor to go. I'm like. Yeah, I've got work to go to. I've definitely got to go. But I genuinely was like pissing a sweat, and I don't sweat that much.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, I've got to go. Yeah, I've got to go to work. Although I could see her doing this is just dropping from the fucking window. She's like, oh no, I'll find the keys. I'll find them. Don't worry. I'm like, oh, yeah, all right, fair enough, bye.
You know, she's probably listening to this podcast, right?
Watch out for your number one.
She knows who she is. About
so, for everyone listening, Nico lives at... No, I'm joking. I'm not
I've stayed in 3 different countries since then. I'm fine.
Yeah, sure. But no, like, I think this is just one of the things that this movie does so well. It's like, as I think one of you mentioned it earlier, like, so much that happens in this movie is so understated, but yeah, it's so uncomfortable. It's so creepy. It's so tense.
I think, achieve that here is the subtleties, little things, by keeping most of the camera where Paul is. So in that room, locked in, that's unsettling. It makes me uncomfortable. I'm claustrophobic. You know, there's all these little things, and then we have the score that's kind of telling us sort of how to feel, when a good score is supposed to do that.
Yeah.
You know, and just these little subtle things that if you're paying attention and you're really into the movie, it puts you right on the edge, because you're supposed to be there. And so that means it's doing a really good job by getting under your skin in very small ways that you don't even realize that it's manipulating you and into feeling this. And this is what a good movie should be doing, you know, by setting the scene for you.
100%.
Well, this is the second week. You've been on 2 episodes, and we're all in full agreement about the movies. I think we're going to need to pick some movies that we all have very different opinions about. But, you know,
I can supply those.
I'm sure we'll definitely find some.
Oh, we can supply those too. Don't worry.
I'm going to open up.
Oh, I believe it.
The last point I have, and then again, I'll open up the floor to you guys for any additional points that you guys want to make. Ultimately, you know, I think this also goes down to something as, especially people with, you know, addiction and mental health issues, going back to that, you're your own worst enemy. Because ultimately, yes, had she just rescued him and taken care of him and saved him, she would have just ended up being like a lifelong friend. He probably would have dedicated a character named her. He probably would have wrote stories about her and included her and been, you know, like, so ultimately she's just her own worst enemy.
But also, yeah, she does say one telling line. She says, you don't know what it's like to have to lose someone like you.
Yeah.
like a person of your caliber has no idea what it's like to lose a person like you.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not a movie star type. I'm not, I can't remember the exact spiel she says, but.
Yeah, it's a, not a movie star type. Yeah, she does say that. Yeah.
Yeah, she's like, you don't know what it's like to lose a person like you. So she was, and that's a really big clue into like, she's never going to let him go. And you also know that he's figuring that out at this point too. Yeah. And you're like, oh shit. She isn't going to let him go. This is can only win like in one way, and somebody's going to die.
Yeah.
It's the only way.
Okay. Like I say, I will open up the floor to you guys for any additional points that you guys want to make or anything that I've not covered or we've not covered so far. Candy, anything else that you want to touch upon with this movie?
I don't know. There's so much. I don't really know how to sift through it all. Let me think. Like I said, I really wish we could have gotten a little more detail, but I think with the detail that we do get in the movie is enough to like her backstory. It doesn't matter. You know that you find out that she's a murderer. She's got some major undiagnosed and unmedicated, untreated mental health problems that are dangerous. Munchausen's by proxy because, you know, she's harmful to herself and to others. You know, those are the kind of people that desperately need to be treated, and she's untreated, and she has isolated herself, and anybody who enters that domain is now in danger. And you know that it's keeping it so claustrophobic, keeping it so shut off was the way to do this movie, and I think it did a really good job at that. I like that. I think it was Rob Reiner did a fucking amazing job with it, and he started in comedy. I can't remember the show. Was it, it'll come to me at a really random moment, but I don't remember it now. It was in the '70s to go on and do this and to direct a lot of other really great Stephen King adaptions, other great movies. But this was really like Rob Reiner doing something against his own type in directing. And I thought it was a fucking great job. Like, yeah, you did a fucking good job. You read the book, you understood the assignment, and you delivered.
And I would agree that, like, you know, reading the book, it's so easy sometimes. And Stephen King, I think, has said this before as well, you know, about some of his adaptations. And I think The Shining is probably the best example of that, where, you know, they can make a lot of changes. And I think that was Stephen King's always apprehensive about people making changes from his novel. Obviously, as we all know, you can, like you said earlier, kind of, you know, you can do a lot more in a book than you can do in a film. Some things just don't translate, you know, from book to film, and changes have to be
made. I.e. The Dark Tower. But gladly, right now, that's in Mike Flanagan's hands.
Yeah.
And he is doing at least five seasons to cover 8 books. I think it's on Amazon has it. And I'm very much looking forward to that. But we've seen Stephen King works in other people's hands where it maybe didn't go so well, including his own as far as directing.
Yeah. Like The Dark Tower, you bring up The Dark Tower. I was looking forward to that so much, and I thought that was just awful.
I know. And I was like, they only did one movie. I was already apprehensive when I'm like, you can't just do one movie. Yeah. How are you going to do that? There's so much. There's 8 books, and they're big books. And so
I thought they had a decent cast for it.
Lord of the Rings. You know? Yeah,
I thought they had a decent cast for it, but the problem was it was too short.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. If they'd elaborated it, like what they're doing with Dune. Dune was one movie in what was it, the '70s or eighties when it was out, and now they're remaking it, and it's going to be like 4 movies they're talking about.
Well, that's a lot to cover. There are so many books in that series, you know.
Exactly.
And so, like fans who are, you know, in the Dark Tower series has so many fans, like so many people were pissed, including myself, and I was like, when I right out of the gate, one movie, okay, this is gonna suck, and it did. But so like this Mike Flanagan one, I trust him as a director, and two, I know he's gonna be faithful and give us a lot, you know, with when you have 5 seasons of a show as opposed to like a series of movies, even you can do so much more with it. So
I think it's all like you said.
So yeah, I'm looking forward to that as well,
regardless of whether, you know, what any of us think about Mike Flanagan and his work.
Sorry.
One thing I can say though, like regardless of how I feel about his work or how I feel about, you know, Dr. Sleep in particular, you know, one thing he was faithful to that book. And you know, I will give him that. And like you say, he tried to fix what he felt, or Stephen King felt, were the wrongs of Stanley Kubrick's version. And
he tried to merge the two.
Yeah. And you know, I think if you're going to put it in somebody's hands, I think Mike Flanagan's obviously proven that he's the guy for Stephen King stuff at the minute. You know, he's the guy who can be trusted with his work. Because again, for all the things I say about Doctor Sleep, I still don't. I don't think it's a bad movie.
And it had a pretty good cast.
What was it you scored that again?
I can't remember. I don't see it on the leaderboard.
Oh, okay, fair enough. So it wasn't that bad a movie, no?
I just found my score, and
Flanagan has what bad. Flanagan has what I like. Taken from more of like grindhouse trash kind of exploitation directors, they have like a stable of actors, and one of his is Kate Siegel, his wife.
Yeah.
Who's in all of this stuff, and she's phenomenal. And Henry Thomas, who I grew up with in E.T., but he's still a fantastic actor, and he's in all of Flanagan stuff. I mean, we have a great stable of people that can pull his shit off.
Yeah.
He's great, you know, like, he's a great director, and he's got great actors that he works with all the time. So I like that about Flanagan.
Just on that note as well, sorry, a slightly different note. Did anyone watch the Castle Rock TV show?
No. Sean did. I don't know why, but I just, he would watch it because I tend to get up later in the mornings than he does. He gets up fucking 5:30 when he doesn't work. I'm like, what is wrong with you? And he'll be watching. He was watching it, and I didn't want to start all the way from the beginning without him. And I was just like, I didn't feel compelled enough to do it on my own. I was like, no, that's all right.
So the story to Annie Wilkes is the sort of central theme, I think, of season two. Of Castle.
Oh yeah, I remember hearing, he was telling me about it, yeah.
I've only ever watched like the first couple of episodes of it, and I remember it being all right. I can't remember why I didn't watch. I didn't stop watching it because I didn't enjoy it. I just think I didn't have the time at the time to like take on a new show, which sometimes for me is the issue with horror TV shows, because you know you need to invest a lot of time and effort into actually sort of keeping up with it.
Because then you got
to
fit in the movies and other shit that you do.
Yeah,
and
so
it's a lot.
It's something that I just wanted to check to see if either of you had seen it. Maybe you could furnish us with some more details about it. But I know that's a sort of central plot line in season two. So I think I might go and try and check it out, because I think it's on Amazon.
I remember it being confusing what I did learn, but I don't remember what it was that I learned. Like, they're having this Annie Wilkes backstory, but it doesn't jibe right, and this character shouldn't be there. And
probably because they're also like throwing in all the other sort of universes that are part of Stephen King's wider universe, you know, makes it maybe just that long.
I thought it was ambitious sounding, but maybe too ambitious.
I can't remember if there was more than two seasons of it. I don't know how long it ran for.
I have no idea.
But I think it's maybe something
I've got a phone handy. Give me a second.
I think it's definitely maybe something I'll pick up. On that note, then, Nico, is there anything else you'd like to add about Misery?
Well, I was hoping you'd do a bit more filler, because I was waiting to check how much Castle Rock seasons there were, but you've just cut me off, you motherfucker.
Well, I'm sure you're capable of doing more than one thing, you know, at a time.
No, I'm too gormless for that. Two seasons, by the way.
There was just two seasons. Okay, I thought there
two
was.
Two seasons.
Okay. No, are you done? Is that you done then, yeah?
The other thing I liked about the movie was the smudge part when she's going on about the paper, you know, explaining it to her like a 2-year-old, and you can see she's pissed off but wrong at the same time. She's like, "Oh, fine then," sort of thing. I did like that.
I think what it comes to me is because that scene's a really good example of it as well. But even some of the other scenes, there's something, and it's also actually, you know, just to quickly get into it, something, you know, when we're talking about the other sort of like romanticizing moments of the scenes, you know, where we might think there's that romantic element between, or she perceives there to be that romantic. She's very childlike in a lot of her reactions and a lot of how she perceives.
Yeah, very coquette type, where it's like, you know, like how I would act more when I was like reading, you know, Bram Stoker's Dracula when I was a kid, you know, like, it's so romantic.
Yeah, and
like, girls sometimes do that. I'll pretend I'm dumb, they'll like me more, and I fucking hate that.
As a blonde named Candy, it has been useful, I will admit, but I only do it so people will think that I'm dumb, so I can, like, whoop their ass at being smart later.
Yeah. See, that I would love, but the ones that do it just permanently, oh my god, oh, you're so smart. Fuck off and die.
But society tells us that men want us that way. You don't understand the female experience. We're told we're supposed to be smart, but act dumb. We're supposed to be this and that. I mean, my real name is Candy, and people are like, well, that can't be right. Was your mom a hooker? You know, like, they expect me to be dumb. Seriously, I'd go to
home from, like, hooker.
Yeah, third grade, I went home and I said, "Mom, what's a hooker?" She's like, "Where'd you hear that?" I'm like, "School." Because they're like, I'm blonde, I'm candy, you know, I must be an idiot, or my mom was a prostitute or a stripper. People ask me if it's my stage name. I'm like, what stage? Like, no, it's my real name. So like somebody named Candy, why I chose the name Candy, the final girl, because the girl named Candy who's blonde would never be the final girl. So somebody has to represent.
But no, but I think ultimately, I think that's one of the other reasons why, you know, I find this movie so unsettling at times, because it is quite uncomfortable watching that. And like you say, she's in a very childlike state. She obviously has, like we've talked about earlier, with the mental illnesses, the undiagnosed mental illnesses she has. Whether that's some sort of trauma that's caused her to be like that, something's made her revert to this sort of childlike state, it makes me quite uncomfortable watching that and watching
her. Not to mention she's armed with an ass load of hospital supplies and drugs, like scheduled drugs that are impossible to get. So you know that, you know, she's nefarious if she has all this stuff, because it would be locked up in a...
She stole it somewhere.
The head RN would have a key to that, and she has a shit ton of it.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's frightening.
Okay, right. Well, with that being said, then I'm going to move us on, because I'm just sort of looking at the clock and weary of the time. And we're.
Are you falling asleep?
No, I'm not falling asleep. But it's very telling when we've got like a movie of depth, because you know I think we're already about half an hour longer in this movie than we were when we did Army of the Dead.
Are you trying to tell me the last one was so in depth? It was just unbelievable. Come on, Ian.
Our review was perfect. Our review was perfectly in depth. Unfortunately, there just wasn't that much depth for us to review. So
exactly.
Like reviewing a puddle.
So
a puddle with an oil spill in it, because it's just fucking too much color doing nothing.
0 out of 10 would not recommend this puddle.
Yeah.
3 out of 3 wouldn't fucking recommend the puddle.
Yeah. Anyways, so I'm going to move us along, and we're going to talk about some trivia.
I'm sure if we bashed your head in, all sorts of secrets would come tumbling out.
As always, we start off with the finances of the movie. So according to IMDb, this movie had a budget of $20 million. So pretty big budget for 1990, you know.
Pretty big,
you know. But you know, that's still, you know, less than a third of the budget of Army of the Dead, and you know.
But adjusted for inflation, not bad.
Yes, of course. And its box office run, it grossed worldwide $61.2 million, so just about tripled its budget. So a financial success, and you know, it was a critical success at the time as well. Which is great. You know, we love it when movies who deserve to be successful are actually successful. There's too many instances of like fantastic movies, specifically horror movies throughout history, that just bombed because people weren't interested in seeing them. I.e. The Thing, for example, is probably your best example of an absolutely incredible movie that just didn't
happen. Almost any John Carpenter film, he was ahead of his time, so almost all of his shit.
Yeah.
But now is revered, 100%. You know what I mean?
Does anyone know the working title of this movie?
The only thing I know, can I get one bit of trivia? Because I only know one bit.
Alright, okay.
I know who they wanted instead of Kathy Bates. And I think it would have been a totally different movie.
I've got quite a few names that were in consideration for Kathy Bates' role.
Well, the main one was Bette Midler. Could you imagine Bette Midler doing that?
Yeah, but so Bette Midler was actually offered the role. So it wasn't even a case of she was considered. She was offered the role.
I didn't know she was offered it, but I knew she was the one they wanted.
She turned the role.
I think she would have done justice because she had Broadway and acting, you know, history, but it would have been a bit more campy. You know what I mean? It would have been campy.
That's what I'm meaning. Yeah, this would have been a totally different movie if it was her. Like,
I think,
like totally, she could do serious. She could do serious, but in the 90s, there was no way she was going to be doing it serious.
I think, you know, Bette Midler and Kathy Bates have relatively similar sort of theater backgrounds as well. You know, Kathy Bates was a very theatrical actress, you know, in her sort of formative years. So from that aspect, you know, I can see why, you know, they would have been like, she'd have been someone in consideration. For as much as I love Bette Midler and some of the things she's in, I don't think she's got the acting chops that Kathy Bates does.
Well, the difference is, and I like to insert where I spend a lot of time doing theater and directing and acting, all that. When you act on the stage is different than how you act in front of the camera. You have to pull back. You have to hold back. We're on the stage. You got to play to the back of the theater. And some people can make the transition from theater to film quite well. Bette Midler still plays every movie like she's in a theater. And Kathy Bates was able to shed that and pull back a little in a film.
Yeah.
Whereas I don't think Bette Midler does that.
No. And I think the problem now is as well with obviously like she's but like you say delivered she's delivered great performances. She's a fine actress. You know, she's in some great things. She can do serious, but we all now also we all now just see her as well as one of the Sanderson sisters, for better
the,
or for
the main
worse,
one, yeah.
You know, because that's such an iconic role, and it's the role.
I'm not a Hocus Pocus fan at all,
but it's the role that's perfect for her because it allows her to give a theater performance in a movie because that's
even in like Beaches, which was big in the late 80s. That was a serious role, but she still kind of chewed the scenery. That's what she does, and that's why she's embraced.
Yeah.
But she did do some serious bits in Beaches. She did prove she could serious act as well.
Yeah,
I did like that.
I think though, I think Tandy, you brought it up there as well about sort of the differences between acting in a theatre and acting in a movie, and that obviously definitely led to some tension on set as well because it's quite well known that there was tension on set between Kathy Bates and James Caan because of their different methods of acting. James Caan really didn't do a lot of rehearsal, if any at all, and obviously Kathy Bates, being from a big theatre background, wanted to rehearse everything really to death.
Well, you gotta have your marks in your mind. When I hit this point, this is when I pivot and I say this, and this is, you know, when you come from a theatre background, that's always in your head.
Yeah.
Where's my mark? Where do I stand? Where's the best lighting? Where do I need to be for this?
Yeah. But you know, in a sort of backward way, it may actually have also assisted the movie, the fact that they did have this difference. As Rob Reiner said,
yeah,
that,
didn't like each other that much.
He'd obviously told Bates that the frustrations he's having about that, you know, should put it towards hating Caan as a character, you know, as Sheldon as a character, and sort of focus it into that. So it may have inadvertently actually helped the movie as well. But even though they were famously didn't really get on very well on set, they did become really good friends. They became lifelong friends after this movie had finished filming. Kathy Bates came out. Obviously, James Caan, you know, passed away in 2022. You know, which was very sad. And you know, she came out and said, you know, one of her, looking back on it, filming Misery was one of her favorite, most favorite sort of filming experiences. So it is nice to know that they were. They were lifelong friends after it as well. I kind of.
I got a factoid that I don't know if you know.
Go for it.
It does, about this movie. When Stephen King got in his car wreck, I believe it was 1999. I remember I was out of high school, or maybe 1998, because I graduated in 97. He got in that wreck that almost killed him, that he ended up writing into the Dark Tower series. Kathy Bates was kind of universally hated for a minute because she sent him like a bouquet and like a funny note that said "Got novel." Referring to the drug in this, and I thought it was clever, and Stephen King thought it was clever, but a lot of people were like,
"That
was in
brilliant.
Poor taste." And I was like, "I thought it was
That's
kind of funny."
Genius.
I know, right? And I was like, "I thought it was kind of funny." I remember reading it in People's, and they had like their picks and their pans or something, and it was a pan, like a terrible thing that she did. And everybody's like, "Oh, how bad taste!" I mean, this is early internet days, but like, I thought that
Fuck
was kind
off,
of clever.
Brilliant.
And if Stephen King thought it was clever, then it's fucking clever. It's a law now.
Yeah.
That's fucking amazing. I never knew that.
The fucking cojones on her.
Aye. Everyone knows she's got big balls.
Listen,
that's right.
She doesn't get a fuck.
I fucking love Kathy Bates. I think she's so
Same.
She's absolutely hilarious as well. Like, she's so funny in some of the things. I know not everyone's a massive fan of the series, but her performance in American Horror Story Coven.
Yeah,
I think she's absolutely hilarious in that. And
she, is she the slave owner or something
she's
like that
the
of a plantation
owner, but
or something?
So many,
yeah,
she's been
a while since
Dina. It's kind of maybe a surprising thing to say, but she's so funny in that movie. Like, again, it's another one where she's just sort of chewing the scenery. But anyways, I'm going off track again. But no, that's so funny. She's just a genuinely funny person as well. So.
I used to love seeing her on stuff like Parky and, you know, Interview and stuff, because I used to be well into that when I was younger. And whenever she was being interviewed, she would always come out with something fucking bad that she wasn't meant to say. It was always brilliant.
Yeah.
Can't think of any off the top of my head, but always used to have you in laughter, you know?
Yeah.
You that one that I just said was like, it stayed in my mind all these fucking decades. I'm like, well,
yeah.
I remember a funny thing.
Brilliant, like.
Stephen King has stated in interviews that Annie Wilkes is his favorite character to write due to her unexpected depth and sympathy. And I think that really comes across as well, not just in the book, but in the movie as well. That, you know, it's not Stephen King that's directing the movie, but I think you can really sort of feel that in the movie, that there's this sort of just love, almost love for the character, even though she's this terrible person. So I think that's interesting. Just to go back to what we were saying about people who were considered for roles, so obviously we already said that Bette Midler turned down the role of Annie Wilkes. She thought it was too violent. She later called herself stupid for turning this movie down. Fair enough. But there was a multitude of other people who were also considered for the role, including Barbara Streisand was considered for this role.
Oh.
Yeah.
No.
Babs, no.
Jessica Lange.
Barbara Streisand.
Jessica Lange was also considered for this. And I'm like on the fence about whether or not I would have liked to have seen
at
that.
The time period for Jessica Lange, I don't think it would have been great. Yeah. I think as she got older, it would have been perfect. She could have done it because I don't think anybody would have seen her in that light because she had played ingenue roles throughout the 80s and just kind of was really not at that point in her career. And Kathy Bates could just come right in and just establish herself.
Yeah.
So I just couldn't see Jessica Lange at that time making such, I think people would have not received the movie as well because they're like, Jessica Lange is not a bad person, you know?
Yeah.
Obviously, as well as with any movie, there was multiple people who were up for the role of Paul Sheldon. Jack Nicholson was offered the role, obviously well known to Stephen King fans though for his role in The Shining. He's passed in the movie stating that he didn't want to do another Stephen King book because of his experience with Stanley Kubrick on The Shining. Don't really blame him. But maybe you know, should talk to some of his co-stars in that film because I think they got it a little
bit.
But
could you imagine Jack Nicholson doing such a understated role because he chooses scenery too.
But he
couldn't have done Paul Sheldon.
It's literally the same thing, isn't it, with the Bette Midler? Could you imagine this being Bette
right,
Midler
right,
Jack
same
Nicholson?
Thing.
Like it would just be so jarring. But I think you need to speak to Shelley.
But saying that, they do work together well because they have worked together before, Bates and Jack Nicholson. So they could have.
Yeah, no,
I'm not saying it would be better,
well,
but I reckon it would be good.
Film though, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's a different film.
Yeah.
I think it would have been half decent.
Well, I mean, given some of the other names that were connected to the role, you could have had Dustin Hoffman, who was considered for the role. Yeah,
I would have loved that.
I don't know.
Would you? I wouldn't.
I love Hoffman.
You could have had Ed O'Neill.
Al Bundy?
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, nobody would have taken that seriously because Married with Children was huge at the time. Nobody would have taken that seriously, including me. I would have been like, what? Is he going to sell me shoes or?
I'd be like, why is this not funny?
Yeah.
Or you could
have been weird.
You could have had Bill Murray.
Absolutely not.
See, definitely not in the 90s. Like, Bill Murray can do serious, but not then.
That's just
I don't know that I could see him in the Paul Sheldon role. You need somebody who can scale back and
yeah.
I don't know.
I think, listen, ultimately, at the end of the day, the casting for this movie is just they got it.
Oh, no,
the
casting is good, like.
Just a couple other pieces for me in terms of trivia. Obviously, I've already mentioned about Kathy Bates winning an Oscar. She was the first woman to win an Oscar for Best Actress in a horror or thriller due to this movie. And even since then, there's not been that many since, you know, I think.
It's like, what, Jodie Foster for Silence of the Lambs?
Yeah.
A couple, it was like, what, a year or two later?
Didn't Natalie Portman win for Black Swan?
Yeah, that was much later.
That was much later. But I think those are the only two off the top of my head that I can think of.
Yeah, those are the ones I can think of.
You know, since then, so... quite the achievement, but that I think that speaks more about, you know, the Oscars than it does about performances in horror, because
it does.
There's been a lot of performances out there that have been criminally overlooked by the Academy. So
Toni Collette from Hereditary is probably the biggest one for me.
Yeah.
It's the one that he always says.
It's the one I always say, yeah. Absolutely.
I 100% agree with that because she was phenomenal. I think she's phenomenal in everything she does. She's a great actor.
Yeah.
She can do anything, but
she
like that was a fucking Oscar role.
You know, she can do funny, she can do serious, she can do horror. She is really, really talented. I forgot to finish it earlier. So the working title of this movie was How Do You Doody Do? And it just sort of reminds me of like Ned Flanders.
How do you doodly do?
Yeah, that's exactly the thought that came into my head.
It was Dudley Do Right that it fucking reminded me of.
Last piece of trivia that I've got. James Caan once showed up to the set so hungover that none of the footage that was filmed that day could be used. Reiner lied to him, don't know why, and told him that it was due to a problem at the filming lab. but Khan found out the real reason, and because he's a bit of a class act, he did cover the money that the studio lost that day. So, you know,
I was to say, that's a lot of money you wasted there,
that's
buddy.
All right, yeah.
Yeah. But you know, don't show up to your work hungover when you're an actor.
That was a way to say you definitely can't say that.
I'm not an actor.
Well, but I was a way to say, but when I heard you say don't show up to your work hungover, I was a way to go, you liar.
I'm not an actor. I've shown up to my work hungover many, many times in my career.
But obviously, I've never done it.
Yeah. As a mom, I would have been fired. I haven't held a job since 2006. I've been raising my kids. I would have been fired, and that's not something I want to be fired from.
Yeah.
See, as an electrician in that job, I've never, ever done it in the electrician job, honest. But the DJing job, you just carry on drinking. You're not fucking hungover, are you?
Getting the buzz going.
I was starting to feel pretty fucking rough last night. Anyway, that's all I've got for trivia. Obviously, there was a lot more trivia there than there was in our last episode to get into. It's a much more interesting movie to talk about. Any other tidbits from you guys before we move on?
No.
No, I think I'm good.
Awesome. Right, let's move on then to our final segment, and we'll do the ratings and the reviews.
A census taker once tried to test me. I ate his liver with some fava beans and a nice Chianti.
And as always, we start off with the critic scores. IMDb gave this movie a 7.8 out of 10. Metacritic giving it a 7.5. We'll play the game again. What do you guys think the Rotten Tomatoes critics scored this movie? Nico, we'll let you go first with this one.
I'm trying to remember back then if critics were high on it. I'm pretty sure they were.
Well, that's what I'm asking you.
I'm trying to work it out, though. I'll say 75.
75. Candy?
I'm going to go more towards like 80, 82, something like that.
Well, you went the right way this time. I think you lost both of them. Yay! In the last episode. The Rotten Tomatoes critics scored this 91%.
Fuck yeah. Really, they're usually not that nice.
Yeah, really.
I was thinking that myself. That's why I went 70 odd. Because I was thinking 80 odd. And I'm like, it'll never get above that. Not back then.
No, 91%.
So, yeah.
The critics' consensus, elevated by standout performances from James Caan and Kathy Bates, this taut and frightening film is one of the best Stephen King adaptations to date. So they're really high on it. Flip it now to the audience. Candy, we'll let you go first on this. Rotten Tomatoes audience, what do you think they scored this?
I would say I'm going to stick with my same one, maybe 80.
80. Okay, Nico?
I was going to say 80, so I'll add my lucky number, 82.
82. Nico, you went the right way with this one. Rotten Tomatoes audience scoring this 90% fresh, so there's just one point difference between the two.
You're underestimating this one.
So, I know, because I did not think it would be that high on both. Eh?
Both critics.
That doesn't happen very often.
Really, nice. Really high on this movie. There's no audience consensus on Rotten Tomatoes, but yeah, so really, really high scores there. As always, with all of the movies that we cover, we throw it out to our followers and listeners, asking for your scores and opinions. Here is just a few of them. We'll kick off with Ren, friend of the show, former guest on the show. He always has nice, interesting things to say about the movies that we cover.
His reviews are great.
Yeah, it's no secret that it's rare that filmmakers are able to accurately translate King's written work to film. But Misery was one of those rare exceptions back in the day. A few subtle changes that doesn't take away from the excellent pressure cooker of tension. Bates is completely unhinged in arguably her finest performance. And who doesn't like a good hobbling? 8 out of 10. So,
Ren, that's a pretty good review.
Yeah. Newman, also former guest on the show, regular contributor to the show from Movies for Days podcast, also gives it an 8 out of 10. A grand exercise in tension building in a small, localized setting with two titan actors going toe-to-toe. Easily one of the best Stephen King adaptations, a great winter watch. I think we can all see the sort of theme that's coming through here and the level that people are on. Sarah Marie on Twitter gives it a 10 out of 10. Absolutely brilliant acting, the setting, everything falls into place for this classic movie. Biohazard Drew gives it solid 10. Perfect movie, Very tense and frustrating watching Paul fail to escape so many times until the final fuck yeah moment with the typewriter bonk. Bet it was great to see you at the cinema. And finally, Francis Lalonde on Facebook also gives it a 9. I'm hesitant to give it a 10, but for no reason I can single out, I guess I'm not its number one fan. I'd put off watching this for way too long, and at first I wasn't sure I'd be able to get into it. My apprehension was unfounded. Such a great film. So there we are. Obviously, thank you to everyone who gives us your scores and opinions. We can't read them all out. We simply don't have the time to, but there was quite a few others in there as well. On average, all of our listeners gave this movie a 9 out of 10, which is super fucking high. A really great score.
That's amazing.
I think it's possibly like the 5th or 6th highest score that's ever been given out by the audience on the show. And
impressive.
You know, the only movies that are above it that I'm just trying to sort of quickly... There's 5 movies that have gotten a higher score from our listeners, and it's The Thing, Halloween, Jaws, Alien, and Aliens. So, you know, it's right up there.
You're fighting Titans, basically.
You're fighting Titans right up there. That's literally our top 5 movies. That's the only thing they've scored it higher. And even then, you know, this is pretty fucking close to a couple of them. But, excuse me, that just leaves the two of us. Candy, we'll let you go first this time. On a scale of 0 to 10, did I say the two of us? I'm still in my old habits. That just leaves the three of us.
I've been replaced. I'll see you later. Nico, I've been replaced. It's fine.
Nico, I've been trying to replace you from day one. This is just the
beginning. Fuck you.
And you chose me. You're
never getting rid of me, you cunt.
Wow. That just leaves the three of us. So, Candy, on a scale of 0 to 10, what would you rate Misery?
This was a tough one for me. I want to give it 10 out of 10. I desperately do. But I just wish there was a little bit more. Like, give me 25 minutes more, 30 minutes more of just more that we could have done. And I think, you know, a couple of years later, they would have absolutely done that. But at the time, no, you just didn't make movies that long. So that makes me have to give it like a 9.5. It's so close to being perfect. It's so well done, and it's definitely my favorite adaptation of King's work, and I am so stingy with that shit. A lot of people would say like The Mist has some problems that this movie doesn't have. Obviously, I'm gonna do the usual. Yeah, the book's better. It is, because books are cool. But I love movies too. So, you know, I think given the material, they did what they could do with it. All that you could do with it, just a little bit more. Like, I want to give it perfect. I really, really do, but I can't. So 9.5, everybody's great in it. James Caan surprised me. Even at the time, I was just thinking of, you know, The Godfather, and I'm like, oh, wow, okay, this is different. But yeah, it's so fucking good. It's just really good. And I, you know, I did not need to rewatch this movie for this, but I did anyway, because I own it, and why the fuck not? It's so good. So yeah, 9.5 out of 10 for me.
Awesome. Nico, out of 0 to 10, what are you giving Misery?
Well, I saw the movie before the book, and that's the only reason I'm giving it a 10. But I do agree with Candy's points.
Wow, I didn't think you were going to get...
I would have liked more in it, but as I said, I saw the movie first before the book, and it was one of the only ones that I did do it that way. And genuinely, I thought it was just so good. Everything in it, they do less is more in the right places. They've got the right cast, as you said. Everything is just perfect. The score, who would have thought that the score would have been that good for it?
Yeah. Wow, I genuinely didn't think you were going to give this a 10. I knew, obviously, you were going to be high on it. That's only the 4th 10 you've ever given out on the show. The 5th 10 you've ever given out.
Now I'm feeling stingy over here.
It is genuinely probably, like, I hate to say it, but it's probably the best Stephen King movie.
I agree.
Fair. Okay.
Like, rewatching it, it's went to number one spot, you know what I mean?
So, here I come, the stingy one. I think...
This has got to be like an 8.
I'm going to give this a 0. No, I'm joking. I think this is...
8.5.
This is... the greatest Stephen King adaptation. I think it's possibly the one that sticks the closest to this, like, it sticks so close to the source material, but changes just enough to make it not only just like its own thing as well, but it just, it gets that balance so right. Because, you know, we spoke about it in the episode, it's so easy to get that balance wrong and put something from a book into a film that's just not possible. It doesn't translate. You know, we've talked about that. The casting's great. The score's great. Everything is great. The only reason I'm not giving this a 10 out of 10 is because I just simply have other movies that I prefer. And this is like an elite. We're talking like the elite levels of movies here. We are talking the titans of
movies.
Yeah,
I was sweating going back and forth myself.
You know, I'm going to give this a 9 out of 10. So I'm being the stingy one, but like it's super minor. It's super minor. I don't give 10s out of 10s on this podcast, though. Everyone knows that. Even my favorite movies of all time.
Even when he doesn't do it.
To Nico's, you know, chagrin, I don't give out 10s out of 10s on this show. So I'm going to give it
even a... when I've heard him say he would give a movie a 10. He's never given the movie a 10.
It's weird that I started out the show on these two episodes because I'm usually the most generous rater on anything ever. And I've learned after all these years, I can't give everything 10s just because I feel bad for it or something, you know.
Exactly.
I don't give it out. I genuinely think this is the best Stephen King adaptation after rewatching. If I hadn't rewatched it, it would have been a 9. But now I've rewatched it, it's been bumped up to a 10. Because it hasn't aged or anything, it's perfect.
I think had this been like the 20th 10 you'd given out on the podcast at this, you know, point in our history, then yeah, I would maybe be like, oh yeah, you give everything 10. It is only the 5th you've given out. And again, you know, the other ones you've given out are for Aliens, they're for The Thing, they're for The Omen, and they're for The Lost Spot. You know, so like, it's a rare thing for you to give out. So I will let you know that. You guys were guessing, what, 15th to 20th for this movie. So all of our scores combined with
the listeners... I thought the critics would have been so low.
Yeah, all of our scores combined with the listeners and the critics' scores gives Misery an average score of 8.9 out of 10, and it means it is in 5th place on our leaderboard.
Nice.
5th place. It is one place.
I was expecting more naysayers somewhere along the line, I guess.
No.
I genuinely thought it would be critics and audience, because I know people who've said, oh, it's not that good. It's all right.
And then
there's a hell of a lot of people that'll just go, the book's so much better. And I'm like, that's what put me off it.
I do think the book's better, but it doesn't detract from the film.
But
the only difference with your one was I saw the movie first. That's the only reason that I can't say that it should have that in it, because I saw this first.
It was only my second Stephen King book. The first was Pet Sematary, which scared the absolute shit out of me. And then Misery, my mom got it when it came out in hardback with that iconic cover with just him and get the windows. He's in the wheelchair, kind of slumped over a little bit. What a great simplistic cover. But it was only the second book I'd ever read by Stephen King. So it does have a place close to my heart.
But we've also talked about that before with other movies, that it really does make a difference if, you know, you have a novel adaptation, whether or not you've read the novel first or seen the movie first. That really does matter for some people and like your perspective on things.
It does to me, because I'm a book nerd, but I also do know that not everything can translate, considering that the majority of the things that happen in Misery, it's all from Paul's perspective and a lot is in his mind. You can't put that in a movie.
I think what I love about this and the ratings that and how it sort of ended up is, you know, when I mentioned the movies that the audience had rated higher in this, and quite rightfully so, we were like, those are like the titans of horror. Those are your big, big hitters. And for me,
like the gimmies, basically.
One thing for me is about Misery, for as much as we love it, I always feel like it's somehow undervalued as a horror movie. When people are talking about the great horror movies, Misery is rarely brought up as like the example of one of the greatest horror movies. And so,
but do you know why I think that is? I have a theory. Mm-hmm. I think that to your average horror view, and I'm just talking like just an average person, maybe doesn't do it, you know, watch horror movies like we do. They when they sit down for a horror movie, it's like a thrill ride, like a roller coaster or something. And this just doesn't have that roller coaster feel to it. It doesn't have a lot of gore. It doesn't have a lot of action. It's a very subtle movie. And some people, that doesn't read for them.
That's my
thing.
But I'm really happy that it's ended up in the place that it's ended up. And it, you know, it's beaten out some massive titans there. you know, just to, for sort of completionist sake, because it's obviously landed in fifth place, it's now knocked the original Nightmare on Elm Street out of our top 10. So Nightmare on Elm Street's now dropped down to 11th, 11th place. So yeah, but that's how good this movie is, you know, and yeah, maybe for one or two of those movies in that top 10, people will say that doesn't deserve to be there. But, you know, by and large, now when you look at that sort of, I would say top 8 that we've got, Aliens, Alien, Jaws, Halloween, Misery, The Thing, Reanimator, and The Omen, you know, you for a lot, those are like interchangeable for so many people. For some people, you know, we've got The Omen in 8th, that could easily be their number 1, or Reanimator, The Thing, you know, that's where you're at, where it's such fine margins. And but yeah. I think 5th, I have absolutely, sometimes when we rate a movie, I think the good thing about the way we do things is that we generally tend to get the true area of where a movie should go because of the way we rate them. Obviously, there's exceptions to that rule, and there's room in there for personal preference.
Don't agree with Halloween 3.
Yeah, no, that's what I'm saying, though. There's room in there for, you know, like, personal preference as well.
You know, Reanimator absolutely deserves it.
I genuinely think Misery is that good a movie that it deserves its spot. Listen, is it going to stay there? Probably not, because there's some massive movies that we've covered that we haven't reviewed that will probably go above it. But, you know, for right now, fifth place, given all the movies we've done, I'm perfectly happy with that being there.
It's pretty good.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm shocked at that. But shocked in a good way, like, shocked at that.
And it's, you know, there's not much room in this world for pleasure.
Like, hey, Misery, we're going to give you your flowers today because we appreciate you.
Yeah. So yeah, that was Misery. You know, a great movie, and luckily, you know, loved by us, loved by the listeners, loved by the critics. Yeah, well, there's not really much more that we can say. And I still managed to be the stingiest out of the three of us. So, you know,
I think you should go first from now on, so you can't undercut it.
I can't do that, Nico. I'm sorry.
Because I'm sure that's what you actually do. You wait to see what we're going. If we're talking about it, you always seem to just go like half a point or a point below. Sometimes
that's what happens when you host the podcast, Nico.
Well, you know, on the other side of the spectrum, my old show, I was the host, and I always went first because
you always were like, get my opinion out there first.
I was always like, it's time for my opinion, and you're going to have to listen to it, and I don't give a fuck what the rest of you rate it. That's just me.
Good. That's the best way
to do it. I'm very opinionated.
Well, that's fine. You two, therefore, can continue to be the first ones to give out your ratings. I'm more than happy to sit back and listen to what you two have to say about the movies. But yeah, so...
And then deduct a point from what we say.
There have been plenty... I might be the stingier of the two of us, but there have been plenty of times where I've rated movies higher than you. Plenty of times.
I think you should write down your score now and just show it at the end so we know you're not cheating.
Fib.
Aye. 3.
Like fucking strictly.
One of them's just blank. This was that shit. It's nothing.
It's like, it'll be like Strictly Come Dancing with a paddle board coming out and being like, 7!
7! I like Lloyd.
Oh, anyways, that is going to do it for this episode. I'm not going to tell you what we're covering next week, because once we go off air, we're going to discuss what we're going to do next week. So stay close to our social media platforms, and you'll get the announcements of what's going to be coming up on the show in the next couple of weeks. That's X at Damn Podcast, Facebook and Instagram at Pod of the Damned. You can email us at podofthedamned@gmail.com, and you can subscribe to us on Patreon, patreon.com/podofthedamned. Don't forget, on our Patreon, you get early access to all the video recordings of this episode. We've been saying it for a few weeks now. We are looking to start up new side series for the podcast, including non-horror reviews. We are looking to bring back old side series to the main show, including our top fives as well. We still have the bucket list horror side series that we started last summer that we maybe will be bringing back this summer as well. So there's still lots and lots going on the show as well. But you've got that on Patreon too. So it's just £1 to sign up from there, patreon.com/podofthedamned. I think that's it. Guys, thank you very much once again for joining me.
Thanks for having me on again.
Thank you for having me.
Yes. And thank you to everyone for downloading and listening to this episode as well at home, and for everyone who interacts with us across our social media. And until next week on the Pod of the Damned, just remember, you're damned if you do, and you're damned if you don't.